Hey, thanks for tuning back in to Therapy Insiders. Let me ask you an honest question. What do you think of this music? Do you like the intro music? Let me know. Tweet at me at Therapy Insiders. The reason I ask is our guest on this podcast is a bit skeptical about this music, as you'll hear in the episode. Well, you know, he's kind of skeptical in nature anyway. And of course, our guest is Adam Meekins, or probably better known as at the Sports Physio on Twitter. Now, Adam and I and Urson for a little bit talked a little bit about the music towards the end, but we talked about a lot of other stuff he's skeptical about as well, such as manual therapy and dry needling and other interventions that are debatable based on research that is still building. Now, Adam is very outspoken on certain topics such as research and following best practice for physical therapy. And we talk about some of that. We talk about his preferences, where the skepticism started, and what he does now, such as his shoulder workshops, and just his philosophy on a lot of things, including making tea. If you have kids around, please don't listen to this episode. There is a lot of adult language, let's call it that. But it is worth a listen, I promise. And before we get into the episode, let's take a little minute and hear a word from our sponsor, WebPT. We are proud to be sponsored by WebPT, the end-to-end business solution for private practice PTs, OTs, and SLPs, providing everything from documentation and scheduling to RCM service, billing software, and outcome tracking. WebPT's mission is to help rehab therapists achieve greatness in practice, and that starts with education. That's why WebPT is offering a free guide to healthcare payment reform. To download it today, visit webpt.com/pay-for-performance. And now, on to Therapy Insiders. Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. Dr. Gene Chirakabrad here with Dr. Urson Religioso. Urson, before we get into the podcasting and skepticism and probably a lot of F-bombs on this episode, let's get a little sweeter. Let's break it down. Let's go a little gentle into this first. You just had a baby. Congratulations.
My beautiful birth announcement is on the podcast. Is on the podcast with the most F-bombs.
this is going to be a nice, I think, nice display of walking the extremes of very infant, just very caring atmosphere. And by the end of this episode, there's going to be complete opposite of that. There's going to be no babies, no caring. Chicken's heads ripped off, blood everywhere. It's going to be that kind of, so if you're a danger by any chance, a whiplash or traumatic injuries, or if you have PTSD somewhere in your history, please be careful with this episode.
Mothers will be covering their children's ears.
Oh God. Yes. If you are starting this episode and there's children anywhere near around and you don't want people to come take them away from you, please put them away.
Right. Well, I did have a baby, our second home birth, my first boy and our fifth child. No, I'm not done yet. I don't know if I'm done yet. Whatever. Maybe not. We have one more seat in the car is what I would say.
I'm pretty sure your wife is going to determine whether you're done or not.
Hey, she always said, even before I wanted kids, she always used to tell people that I wanted two and she wanted four, so we're having six. So, man, I'm only one away from that now.
Oh my God. You know? That's terrifying. Like, we have our second on the way due any day now, and that's
enough for me, man. Two, we haven't even had this one yet, and two, yeah. I'm drawing the line.
The more the merrier, as they say.
If you say so, I don't know about that. But speaking of babies, let's get to our guest today.
Big babies.
So he has, I'll let you do the formal introduction, but
he's been in the world of social media and pushing the envelope of discussion, I think, in a good way, overall good way. The methods is debatable, and we will debate them today. But go ahead, Urson. Let's introduce our guest. Enough getting the audience intrigued.
Right. Well, if you have been on Twitter and social media in general, or you follow sports PT blogs, you may know our guest, Adam Meekins, as the sports physiotherapist, self-proclaimed ARSH, dry needling and manual therapy expert.
World-renowned dry needling and manual therapy expert.
Yes, world-renowned dry needling and manual therapy expert.
Don't forget the K-tape.
Oh, yes. I thought you actually liked KT tape. Didn't you write a blog post where you actually said that despite all the evidence against it, you still like to use it because it works? Like that is your one, that is one of your concessions?
I am a recovering tapist, I think is the word I'll use. I am in therapy for my tape addiction.
Hi, Adam.
Adam Meekins, everyone.
Tape addict.
Hey, first things first, thanks for inviting me on, guys. I think this is it's been a long time coming. We've been planning this for how long now?
At least 6 years.
Yes.
Fuck me, it's
been even before the podcast actually even started.
Yes, before we even knew of each other, we started planning this just because of our connection through the Force.
Adam has the distinction of being one of the only people I've ever blocked on Twitter and unblocked.
All in the span of 1 minute.
No, it actually took months. But I did unblock him, the first person I've ever unblocked.
That's
I feel
fantastic.
Privileged.
As you should. So, Adam, so much to talk about. I definitely want to talk about some of your shoulder stuff that you're doing, which will probably be the more stable and serious stuff that we talk about today. But let's talk about your journey through Twitter and the skepticism and your just the interaction of essentially the brand that you've become. Adam Meekins, the sports physio, but the skepticism, where was that born out of? And was it something that you started out anticipating building, or is it just something that you look at the profession and it's just natural to be skeptical just because of so much BS out there?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I've always had a natural challenging and questioning side. You know, I do like to, you know, find out what people are thinking and where they're thinking it is coming from. It's one that has taken me by surprise as how it's been received, though, because I thought there are a lot more people out there like me, and it's come across that actually there isn't, and I've got this persona as being this sort of, I don't know, black sheep that I've gone out and about and I'm the only one doing it. But I don't see that anymore. I see that there's plenty more other people out there doing the same thing as I am, which is challenging and questioning. But perhaps the difference is the way that I do it. And as you said, maybe it's the way that I am a little bit more blunt, direct, and sometimes, I don't know, not aggressive is the wrong word I use, but a little bit more in your face than other people. Political correctness is not one of my strong points, let's put it like that.
Yeah, I agree. I've followed some of the discussions you've had, and it's very obvious. First of all, a lot of people don't have a sense of humor, and it's hard to grasp sarcasm and humor in print and social media. That's very obvious. But when you have agendas, which everyone does, and I think one of my favorite things that you point out is that everyone has an agenda. And if you're not being objective in some way, or even if you're not calling out some of your own negatives, then you have a very incredibly biased agenda. Like, we're all biased in some ways, and we try to push something forward. But if you can't have an objective discussion about your agenda and point it out there in transparency, then you deserve to be called out in a lot of ways. And I think that's what I really enjoy about some of the stuff that you put out.
Yeah, I think, again, it's recognizing your own biases and trying to be aware of them and keep them in check, which is, as you rightly say, I don't think a lot of people do. I mean, I probably don't. You know, I've got my own biases, and some of them are stronger than others, and it does grate me when people challenge me against them. So I think it's human nature when we're confronted with something that, you know, goes against our beliefs and our thoughts and our opinions. It's hard to look at somebody else's point of view, and I think that's an area that I think we've all got to try and
be aware of and try and develop, but it's something that I do struggle with from time to time. I mean, there was a recent one on about, you know, what was it, about pain and movement dysfunction. If you don't have a movement dysfunction and you're seeing a patient with only pain, is that part of our job? And I've got this very much strong bias is that we are movement specialists. We should be asking people to, or we should be seeing people rather, you know, who have movement dysfunctions or physical limitations, not just pain. Normally it goes hand in hand, but there are therapists out there that believe they are pain therapists rather than physical therapists or physiotherapists. And I've got my biases against that. I see, you know, we are dealing with people in pain, but, you know, we are dealing with people in pain and movement problems. So I've had quite a pronounced sort of discussion and debate about that. But, you know, through that process, it has sort of opened my horizons a little bit. And it has sort of thought, well, perhaps there is a role there as well for us to do something a little bit more. So, you know, it is a process of evolution that when people do challenge you and challenge me, it makes you think about other things in a different way, in a different perspective.
Yeah, I've seen that debate before. I know there are those on social media who say we shouldn't be treating people who aren't in pain, but I feel as if they don't necessarily deal with anyone in any kind of performance or sport aspect. And I get that because I've seen both ends of the spectrum, athletes as well as just chronic centrally sensitized patients. So I get it. And some people move perfectly and they have pain, and some people move terribly and they have no pain. But in the end, whatever your agenda is or whatever your bias is, I don't think you can necessarily tell people that they shouldn't be treating someone who needs help in some way, whether it's movement or pain.
It's just a matter of whether you're the right person to do it.
Right.
That's my argument, and I suppose it's the way I see my skills and my expertise is not to be a pain specialist. Although I have learned exponentially thanks to social media and Twitter on the subject of pain, but you know I am predominantly a physiotherapist who deals with people in pain. But when pain is in isolation on its own, that's not for me, that's for somebody else. I think there are better people out there more suited to help somebody just for that aspect.
I think that's an incredibly astute point, and that takes a lot of self-awareness and ability to have an honest conversation with the person in front of you, with the patient, saying, listen, this is what you're going on, this is what's going on, this is what I'm good at to look at, and I don't think that's necessarily what's going on. Here are some people to go see. That's not the mindset that clinicians have. It's the, if somebody's here, I need to fix them because that's my reputation, that's my business, and it's that fix mentality. But I mean, are we actually really fixing anything?
That's another debate. That is, I mean, but that's a good point. You know, I've got into this situation now where I've specialized my skills and everything so far now that I do the same when I see people with knees and hip problems because I am an upper limb specialist. I very much now will say, you know, if you've got a lower limb problem, I'm not the best guy to see because trying to keep up to date with the research in just the upper limb takes all my time, energy, and enthusiasm. So I very much know that there are better lower limb therapists out there, so I will refer on and suggest they go and see other people. So it's not just in the grand subject of pain, it's also in specific areas of certain physiological conditions and body parts as well.
So yeah, I do the same thing for coccygeal manipulation referrals.
Really, you stopped doing those? I thought that was your specialty for a while.
No, actually, it was my wife's specialty for a while, and she told me you can't miss it. I'm like, I don't care if you can't miss it. She just basically describes like you reach in and you can't miss it.
I don't want to find it.
Yeah, I don't even want to find it.
I don't even think about it.
You do now. we'll add that to the list of dry needling, manual therapy, and
coccygeal manipulation.
Coccygeal manips. All right. So before we move on, I do want to talk to you about some of the controversial stuff like dry needling and your thoughts on manual therapy. But before we go down that spiral, let's talk about the shoulder. What about the shoulder got you interested in it? And what are some of the cool things you found lately?
I think it was a process through first being asked to become a shoulder specialist by a consultant colleague of mine who was working at the same hospital who wanted a dedicated therapist to look after his shoulder patients. So I had that to basically kickstart the process off. But the more I got into the shoulder, I think the more it intrigued me, and the more it sort of, I don't know, kept me entertained, because it is a tricky joint to manage, no matter what people say. It's one of these areas that I think does confuse and confound a lot of people, and I've been taught various different methods and ways and means of assessing it and treating the shoulder, and as much as I've done them all, I've always come back to trying to keep things as simplistic as I possibly can, and I find that definitely is a way forward. I think for a lot of things that we've been treating, this over complexity that we tend to like to do, is something that confounds and confuses a lot of people. But the shoulder is one that I see it happening a lot in the most, because of its complex anatomy and biomechanics. People think it has to be more complex in its management and treatment, and I have, although I've done all these complex procedures, I always come back down to the basics, and the basics seems to work for me.
And what are some of the basics? Like, what are some of your go-to foundational things?
Well, when it comes to the shoulder, I like to keep the old basics of, you know, is it a stiff shoulder? Is it a weak shoulder? Is it an unstable shoulder? And that's pretty much the three broad categories that I go by.
So, Urson just had to run to take care of his newborn, but he wanted me to ask you, is there a relation between shoulder position, stability, and pain?
I think there's a relationship between shoulder stability and pain, yes. Between shoulder position, in what sense? As in?
Probably if it's two, let's say, rounded shoulders and it's too anterior, will something like that cause shoulder pain?
Posture. You know,
the typical, yeah, posture, imbalances.
Posture, yeah. Does posture cause shoulder pain? A big contentious area for sure. Mm-hmm. I've read lots of papers around that will claim that it does. There was a recent one done in Japan on a classification system of four different posture types looking at rotator cuff degeneration and tears, and they came to the correlation that, you know, the rounded shoulder kyphotic posture has a higher prevalence of subacromial pain and rotator cuff degeneration and tears. But what they also failed to do was look at all the other factors that also cause rotator cuff degeneration and subacromial pain. So they didn't look at work environments, they didn't look at activity levels, they didn't look at other health conditions, they didn't look at diabetes, etc., all these other factors that can also cause pain and discomfort from the shoulder tendons and subacromial space. So I see a lot of these postural papers out there that will claim that posture is a factor in shoulder pain, but it's all cherry-picked data. It all looks at this correlation of posture in isolation. It doesn't look at it in conjunction with all the other factors that we know also cause problems. So I see that a lot. You know, this cherry-picking of data and correlation, as we all know, does not equal causation.
No, but it's talked about all the time, and I feel like research in itself is very much misunderstood in how it's used, because some people talk about, they find research and they, like, it's gospel, and there's no 100% research. Like, research is in statistics and percentages, so it's essentially a guide. It's a framework to guide your treatment and then in your clinical practice and using other research. So if you don't have a good grasp on that, you can gravitate towards something to further, again, your agenda or your bias. Like, if you have a practice bias, I did this at work, let me find some research to support what I found, which I feel like happens a lot. But shoulders are interesting to me because I played baseball in college. And if you ever played baseball and you didn't have a shoulder injury of some sort, you're not a real baseball player. it has to happen. It doesn't have to be a serious injury, but there's always something, particularly with rotator cuff. So when dealing with treating certain issues, and I know there's a lot, but we can talk about a few, specifically like a rotator cuff. Let's talk about some treatments. Exercise is huge, right? If at this point you're not doing some kind of exercise, you shouldn't be in the clinical profession. But manual therapy is still very much part of the profession as well. I mean, that's, manual therapy is like a holy grail for a lot of people. How do you still integrate any hands-on treatments? Is there any benefit to it, or is it pretty much mostly placebo?
big question that is, Gene. Do I use manual therapy? I'm going to be honest and say yes, I do. Do I use it as much as I did do? Absolutely not. You know, if I had to give it a percentage of how many patients I use manual therapy on, I would say it's probably 10%. And do I use it in the shoulder? Very little, I think I would say now. I mean, I use probably manual therapy more on other parts of the body when I do see them occasionally. So,
like the costagial stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Yeah. That. But yeah, when it comes to does manual therapy work in the shoulder? It's like, does manual therapy work in any area? And it defines what you mean by work. Does it give short term, temporary, transient effects to give you that fucking word that I hate, or saying that I hate the most, the window of opportunity to allow you to do your exercises, which is the most common excuse that I hear therapists using it for? Yeah, of course it does. You know, you can get these short-term effects by grabbing hold of somebody's skin and giving it a bit of a rub and a poke, or finding a joint and pressing it, or even worse, God forbid, sticking a needle into something like people tend to do. So, you know, all these things that we do to patients definitely do something. They change something. But, you know, is it anything that's fixing from a – or fixing, wrong word. Is it anything that's addressing the long-term issues? No, it doesn't. And the effects are very variable. And that's the other thing that started to piss me off with manual therapy and dry needling and stuff and all these other methods that I've been taught to use and don't use anymore, is that, you know, I've just found it very highly individual and variable in its effects. And I'm not a fan of looking like a twat sometimes. You know, you go around and explain to a patient that you're going to do this and it's going to make it feel better and everything, and you spend 10, 15 minutes doing something and the patient gets up and goes, well, that hasn't worked. And I used to come across that a lot. Now, whether that's because of my terrible handling techniques and horrendous manual therapy skills, which I have put my hands up and say I probably have got, because I would say I'm not the best manual therapist, whatever one of those is, but I very much found to say that sort of negative effect from a patient that you've built up, let's say this manual therapy or whatever you're going to do to them, and say this is going to work, this is going to make you feel better, this blah blah blah, and then they turn around and say it doesn't, it's like egg on your face. So I thought, I'm not prepared to do this anymore. I'm not prepared to put myself in that situation, so I'm going to go back to the one thing that I know does work, and that's always the movement therapy, the exercise therapy.
Yeah, so obviously it was because you're a crappy manual therapist. That's the answer. Yeah.
Absolutely, you know, it's all about the skill. You know, it's the skill in palpation and finding the right spot and being able to do it, which again is what's commonly bandied at me. That's what people say. You know, it's your lack of skill which gives you your poor effects. Well, when you look at the reviews and the systematic reviews of everything with manual therapy, expertise and skill has very little to do with it.
Yeah, when I was practicing regularly, I mean, I was, even when I went to school, I wanted to be a manual therapist. That was, to me, that was the end all be all. I loved exercise, I loved the neuro stuff, but to me, like, my hands, right? My hands can fix anybody. And you do it a couple times, and you get this high from it, because you touch people, they feel better, everybody's happy, everybody's dancing, this is fantastic. But the more I started practicing, and the more I started to do it, when the questions started to come and I didn't feel comfortable giving the answers, you know, like, what is this doing? How is this working? And then the more I started to read research and talk to people, my answer started to become with, well, I don't really know, but here's what might happen and here's what might not. We can still do it if you want. You know, that's about as honest as I could get with the person in front of me. If they still wanted to do the treatment, we would do it. And I tell them, this is what worked with others, this is what hasn't worked. But at that point, like, we would do it, and then there always had to be some exercise, because I felt like if we didn't do that loading, that the stuff that has not only the most evidence behind it, the most proven at that time evidence, that I would feel like I am doing a disservice to that person long term. But I still there's this almost compulsion to do manual therapy, because we were a manual therapy clinic. The person is expecting it, and you almost bias them into a nocebo if you don't do manual therapy. How is there a way to move beyond that? And is there value in that the patient does feel better, even if it's a transient effect?
Yeah, you raise a great point there, that there is, it's very hard to abandon something that you've spent a lot of time, energy, and passion in developing. And you know, and I don't think there is enough redundancy in the physiotherapy profession. That's, you know, stop doing something when the evidence says it has very little or no effect, or it's a placebo. And I think that's a great point, is that when you've been doing something and you get into your habits and you get into your comfort zone and you carry on doing it, it's very hard to suddenly, you know, when the evidence says it doesn't do much or there's better ways of spending your time, to suddenly turn around and abandon it. And there's a couple of times in my career that I have done that. You know, when I look back how I used to manage and treat patients over the years, I was like, God forbid, you know, I want to go back and apologize to all these patients that I did transverse friction fucking massages on their Achilles tendons. And I just want to go back and say, I'm so sorry, because I truly believe that was helping at that time, because, you know, that's what I was taught. And I'm young and naive, maybe, who knows, old and naive, who knows. But you know, when I look back at how I used to practice to where I practice now, yeah, it is something that, say, that is constantly evolving. And is there any tips I would give to people? I would say, yeah, you don't want to be practicing the same way year on year out. There is, should be always something that you are doing differently. You know, if I go back and look at the way I was 2 years ago, or even when I look back at my tweets and stuff that I did 2 years, my thinking, my critical reasoning and my thoughts from 2 years ago, if I go back and talk to myself from 2 years ago, I'd think I was a right dickhead. And so I think, you know, that's something that I try to always think about, that, you know, I always want to make sure that every year or every period of time is that I'm not thinking the same way, I'm not doing something the same way, is because then I know I'm stagnating, then I know I'm not evolving and progressing and following the evidence, which is always changing and always evolving as we know and learn more. So the simple answer is yeah, you know, we have to be abandoning things as time goes on, but we should be also adding things as evidence shows us this is better options to be doing things and treating and managing ways.
Yeah, and for the most part, and let me know what you think about this, I think for the most part, we, not only in healthcare, but in business very much so, we sell perception. That initial sell is the perception that the person will get better, the perception that what we're going to do is going to work. The actual stuff that we do after that is to support that perception. So if we tell the person they're going to feel better and we do manual therapy and they have that transient effect, then the perception is proved right and they feel better. Whether that's good or not, obviously, is determined on your character and your business model. Overall, of course not. You want whatever sustains them the most, right? The model that should be happening is we get people better faster and they get more people in quicker versus having people stay for longer and longer periods of time, which still happens. So, yeah, go ahead. What do you think?
Well, I think that's an interesting perspective, because I think that the difference that we see, I mean, I think it's the UK-US divide. Because in the UK, I mean, I know private practice is over in the UK, but I work predominantly in the NHS, in the National Healthcare System. And that brand in and that business model and that sales thing isn't as big in the UK, well, from my side anyway. So that sort of idea of perception, yeah, I totally get, you know, the idea of making sure that the person in front of you is there. But, you know, do I need to be able to make sure that patient goes away thinking, oh, that Adam Meekins, he's great, because I'll go and tell my colleague, because that, you know, that's the guy to go and see? Because in the NHS, it doesn't work like that. You don't get a choice of who you go and see. You get the patients that are put to see you. So it doesn't matter. Which I think sometimes is a positive and sometimes can be a negative. But that drive to get a patient to be better is driven because you want to get that patient better, not because you want them to go and spread word of mouth and branding and sales side of things.
Right. And I think there's a middle ground between the two. I think, you know, we definitely talk about patient experience or customer experience a lot. And if you step back from whether they're forced to be there, whether they pay to be there, you can still have an objective yet good experience, just because if you're a decent human being, you should know how to treat another human being. And just like you would, if you're taking your mom to a clinic, you don't want to take her to a shithole with assholes treating her, you know? You want a nice person that is going to be professional yet hopefully somewhat human. And I think that's creating that. And in terms of perception and doing things that you feel like are working, a lot of times we just remember the good stuff and we don't remember the negative stuff, or the stuff that didn't work was just, okay, maybe I did it wrong, or maybe the person wasn't ready or something. We justify so many of these things, but we remember that one time you did that one technique and the person stood up and started crying because they were great. That's such a big moment compared to everything else. You'll take that, but you can't scale that all the time. That was a one-time deal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So is that why the shoulder, is that also something that draws you to the shoulder? Because it is such a joint that is dependent on exercise. And I mean, manual therapy aside, well, let's talk about manual therapy for the shoulder. Glides. What's the latest on glides? Because I remember when I was going through school and everything was, you have to do inferior glides if you want flexion or elevation. I mean, is that still part of it, or is that stuff that just makes you want to beat your head against the wall?
And before we continue with Adam explaining all the latest and greatest on the shoulder, let's take a minute, take a break, and hear a word from our sponsor, WebPT. I sat down with Dr. Heidi Janenga, the co-founder and president of WebPT, to learn more about pay for performance. I asked Heidi, what's happening with payment reform and why should providers pay it attention?
Well, Gene, with each passing day, we're moving closer to a completely value-based healthcare paradigm, one in which payers will financially incentivize providers based on their patients' outcomes, not just the volume of services provided to those patients. Soon, it won't be possible to provide subpar therapy and still turn a profit. In fact, it'll be difficult to make any money at all without providing valuable treatment and collecting objective data that backs up the effectiveness of that treatment. And once that data's in, we're all going to know who's performing at the top of his or her game and who isn't. So how do you ensure you and your practice make the cut? You start by tracking outcomes data, and you start right now. To learn more about payment reform and how outcomes factors into it, download our free guide at webpt.com/payforperformance. That's webpt.com/payforperformance, all one word.
Thanks, Heidi. Definitely check out webpt.com/payforperformance. And now let's get back to Therapy Insiders, and Adam is getting ready to tell us about the shoulder.
It does want me to smack my head against. Well, when you talk about the arthrokinematics of the shoulder and the use of manual therapy to restore arthrokinematics of the shoulder, I hear manual therapists getting it complete arse over face before they even start. So the arthrokinematics of the shoulder joint, when you're thinking of the convex concave rules, the Kaltenburn rules, they don't apply to the shoulder joint. So, the belief of, APs and PA gliding inside the shoulder based on biomechanical reasoning alone is completely erroneous. It's a fallacy, because they say that these rules, the slide and glide rules, do not apply to the shoulder socket. So, we've just got to move away from this biomechanical thinking of affecting things through manual therapy. It's just not how it achieves its effects. It's more to do with the non-specific factors. It's more to do with this other buzzword that's going around at the moment, neuromodulation, the new buzzword that everybody uses to use as an excuse to apply manual therapy. So, it's gone from using a biomechanical explanation for some to using neuromodulation. I'm just going to lie you down for 30 minutes and neuromodulate you, rather than I'm just going to lie you down for 30 minutes and put you back into alignment. So I think, again, that the same issues apply with manual therapy, regardless of what excuse you use. It's all about the passive nature of it, again, which is something I'm not keen on. And that term that I hate as well, that fucking window of opportunity. I wish people would jump out that fucking window of opportunity, because I see it more as a window of opportunity for the therapist rather than the patient, personally, a lot of times.
Now, what about stuff like spinal manipulation that has growing evidence that, I remember when I was practicing, stuff like even thoracic manipulations to improve shoulder motion. What do you think about stuff like that?
Yeah, again, I've read a few papers on that as well. And there are some papers that show it does improve range of movement. But you got to ask the question, why? You know, is it biomechanical or is it due to the interaction, the environment and the expectations of having something applied to them, such as an intervention like a manipulation? You know, there's a big theatrical response to manual therapy. You get somebody lying down, you go through your detailed assessment, you know, you're setting up that anticipation for a positive outcome before you even fucking do anything. So, you know, I sometimes say to people, you know, it doesn't matter what you do to a patient, it's how you do it. You know, it's the non-specific factors that go around manual therapy that tend to get the effect. It's not the actual manual therapy itself. So you could poke them with an organic cucumber and probably still get the same effect as one of these bloody metal coat hanger tools that are all the rage at the moment.
What if it's non-organic?
Gone because
what if it's in the non-organic cucumber?
Oh, no, they don't have the same effect as an organic one. The organic cucumbers, they have special non-chemicals inside them, so that makes a difference.
Ah, damn it, I've been doing it wrong all these years. Gotta go with the organic cucumbers. See, I already benefited from this.
Always use the organic veg for your manual therapy. Organic veg for the manual therapy.
Okay, got it for the manual therapy. Okay, makes sense. Fantastic. So the next progression of manual therapy, and I still think, even though there's obviously, like we said, with the literature, it can guide you in a lot of ways. Thoracic manipulations, C-spine manipulations, or cervical for your lingo. I remember I took a. Do you know Jim Meadows? I spent a year with Jim, and, you know, British surly guy, and we get to the neck, and he's we're like, Jim, we want to learn cervical manipulations, and he's like, I'm sorry, what? Cervical manipulations? He's like, listen, cervical manipulations are on the neck. Cervical manipulations is what you do with your wife.
Yeah, we are a country or nations separated by a language. I mean, when I talk of pants, what do you think of?
Stuff around the lower half of me.
Yeah, so when I say pants, you think of what we call trousers, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, no, I'm talking of undercrackers. I'm talking of things, you know, that go underneath your chinos, which is what all you Americans wear as well, isn't it?
Well, some of us. It's a lot of assumption on your part, Adam.
I don't think I've met an American that doesn't wear chinos and a polo shirt.
Oh, Adam. let's not get started on that. Don't get me started on the polo shirts.
No? You got a problem with the polo shirt?
Oh, my God. I hate polo shirts. You must have not. That's my rant on Twitter. I have the whole hashtag no polo. I think polo shirts are like the spork of dressing. You don't know whether you want to be relaxed or professional. You know, spork, the evil combination spoon and fork. You can't make up your mind. So I'm very much anti polo. But speaking of clothes, somebody chimed in on Twitter, Matthew Conti Colombo. He said, does he buy his clothes in the dark? His gear is horrific. Smiley face. I have a feeling you guys have a history.
Yeah, that's Monty. So I know him from our football days. So he worked at Watford Football Club in West Ham, where I've done a bit of work as well. So he's a strength and conditioning coach. And I just find it amusing that he thinks he can give me banter about my dress sense when I've seen him wear some horrendous outfits as well.
That's usually how it works.
He seems to think my dress sense is not up to par according to his standards, but that comes from a man who thinks eating spam out of a can is good etiquette.
Sounds like a nutritionist as well. Fantastic. I figured. I hope not. God forbid. Let's go through some Twitter questions for you. Ryan Michael Smith at ryansmith_ATC asked, how do you, if at all, incorporate and see breathing mechanics play into shoulder problems you may see?
Breathing mechanics?
Yes.
All right. Well, my two tips for breathing is breathe in followed by breathing out and repeat as often as needed.
That sounds pretty legit. Not pretty important for living, I think. That's a good life tip. Hashtag life tip from Adam Meekins. So you don't buy into the whole breathing with a lot of benefits and effects?
Fuck no. I mean, everybody I see with shoulder pain has so much more to work on before I even get down to what their breathing's like. So no, it's something that's very low on my priority list, if there at all. It's normally about a lack of strength and pain and range of movement before I even fucking consider what they're doing breathing wise.
And there's a lot of technicalities. Obviously, we're staying away from specific diagnoses and treatment protocols and all that stuff. That's just not for this podcast. That's really good stuff for your podcast, which is what? You have your own podcast, right? Give our listeners a shout out.
Yeah, I have a little podcast ongoing. We just had our first birthday, actually, this week. So
happy
I'm
birthday.
Quite proud of it. For 1 year old. Yeah, thank you. It was a momentous occasion, and I think it's getting better each time I do it. It's a process of evolution and learning, that's for sure, with these podcasts.
Did you say evolution? Is it an evil podcast? Must have been just what
yeah,
I heard.
Possibly.
Yeah, but it's the...
Yeah, I think the Skype just cut out.
Yeah, the NAF podcast, which is an acronym for something.
Yeah, it's a three-letter word that I like to use often.
Which is what? I'm so curious. I'm just intrigued at this point.
So NAF, not another fucking physio podcast, is what it stands for. So it started off as an attempt to be at a parody, because I was seeing podcasts popping up left, right, and center. And again, if I go back and look at history about how I've changed in a year or two, I quite enjoyed podcasts, but I thought, Christ, every Tom, Dick, and Harry's coming out with one now, and I'm like, what bloody good is all these podcasts going to do? But the more I listen to them, the more I do actually feel like they add shitloads of benefit and information. So I started off as a little bit tongue-in-cheek and a bit of a parody, but I do think podcasts are an awesome resource for therapists and clinicians and patients as well.
I think it was perfect, because it really started out with what you would anticipate and expect from you, and it fed right in. But like you said, like it's an awesome evolution to hear the different episodes and progressions, and I completely agree with you. Like, people always ask me, like, how do you deal with the competition of podcasts? It's like you don't understand. It's this crazy mindset that we always live in, and it's us versus everybody else. It doesn't work that way with media and podcasts, because people absorb this stuff so quickly and so much that they'll listen. As long as you produce quality stuff, they'll listen to you. It's not that, oh yeah, they're going to listen to me, and because they listen to me, they're not going to listen to Adam's podcast. It doesn't work that way. It's just, it builds up. It's a steamroll. All right.
Absolutely. Although I will say, when talking about podcasts, mate, you have got to sort out your fucking podcast intro music. Oh my God. It's like, come on. You got to get into people's earlobes straight away.
You don't
that,
like
that cheesy,
you don't like the
1970s porno music.
No,
yours is better than the cheap 1970s porno music. I'll give you that. But it's more cheap elevator music, and it's just like, oh, come on.
The music. Are you talking about the music?
Sliders, step it up a notch.
Wait, the music, like in the beginning when I do the intro, or the transition music?
Yeah, the intro.
Okay, like when I'm talking.
Well, both really. Even the WhatsApp doc.
Yeah.
Thing and the old and the intro music. It's just, come on, man, step it up a notch. That's all I'm saying.
So listen, you know, maybe some people just have an emotional connection to cheap 70s porn movies. Maybe that's what I'm trying to do, is give them a little flashback to something that makes them happy. Did you ever think about that, Adam? Did you ever put yourself in my shoes to see how
Gene,
I'm thinking?
Gene.
Yeah.
Gene, I wouldn't mind if it was cheap 1970s porno music, but it's not even that good, mate. It's cheap 1980s elevator music.
See, that just hurts, Adam. Words can hurt. Words can lead to pain. I thought you would know that by now with your pain research.
I'm just doing my critical, skeptical thing, man, and, you know, telling it how it is.
You skeptical
son of
a bitch.
Or rather how I see it. Rather.
Listen, you can be skeptical about manual therapy. You do not get to be skeptical about my intro music. That's where I draw the line. That's where I draw.
All right,
but I'll send you a few options. I'm gonna rework it. Now I have to rework my music. But before I flip my shit on you completely about talking about my music, let's finish out with
I've hit sartorial nerve. Have I?
You've poked something, and so I'm gonna poke back. Let's talk about dry needling.
Oh, do we have to?
We don't, but we will. I was going to skip it, but you brought up my music, and I'm going to shove a needle into your trigger point. What is the latest on needling? Do you still feel like you did when it first came out? And what is your overall thought process on dry needling and acupuncture? Feel free to throw that in there as well.
Yeah, well, that's a fine line.
Oh, by the way, before you start, as you're describing this, I'm going to play that same intro music over this entire segment.
So I've got cheap 1980s elevator music going on behind me now, have I?
If you're lucky.
Oh, man. Do I have to really talk about dry needling? I'll be honest. I've given up on dry needling and reading the research around it. So, I mean, the last sort of probably year or so, I probably haven't kept up to date with most of the stuff that's come out, if I'm being honest. So the last thing I think I read was on a systematic review that I think in the upper quarter of myofascial pain that did show some effect. But when you look back at the systematic review of the papers they included, it was a classic case of garbage in, so you're going to get garbage out. So the systematic review showed some benefits, but all the papers that they reviewed in there were just absolute pony. And when I say pony, I mean that in rhyming slang is pony and trap as in crap. So what do I think of dry needling? Again, I think it is it's a theatrical placebo, a bit like the acupuncture is. There's a role in it, you know, and the expectations of what the patient is expecting. It's a noxious stimulus, which again, we know from the research will apply some therapeutic effects for a short term, transient effect for over a period of time, but with variableness from person to person. And again, you know, I think again, when you look at how you apply the dry needling or the acupuncture, there's plenty of studies out there. It says it doesn't matter where you do it, how you do it, what you poke it with, you know, sham or not, or, you know, which location you use it on. There's similar effects. So again, just more evidence that it's not really doing anything mechanical. It's doing something else non-specific. So when it comes to that sort of thing, I've shied away from it. I mean, I trained in acupuncture, in the old Western acupuncture. I went and did dry needling. I practiced it for probably 2 or 3 years. And again, it's something that I've abandoned. It's something I've made redundant out of my evolution as a therapist over the years. I tried it. I thought it wasn't much cop. I found it very variable. Some patients loved it. Some patients didn't get much benefit from it. The more I read about it, the less I thought I'm going to start using this. There's better ways to spend my 30 or 60 minutes with a patient than lying them down and sticking sharp, cold, pointy things inside them. It's not my cup of tea anymore, to use it again, another an English analogy.
Yeah, that makes sense. What kind of tea do you drink?
All of the tea.
Any particular? Do you drink it with honey? Is that a British thing? How do you take tea usually?
What the fuck? Honey in tea?
No, that doesn't happen in Britain?
Absolutely. Not unless you're a heathen. You know, you drink tea out of a china cup with your little pinky up in the air, and you sip it off a little china cup and a saucer.
While mixing a puff from your pipe, right?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I thought. See, I'm big on coffee, and I figure I need to make a transition to tea eventually, or at least supplement it, just to step up my my game, you know, just to give that aura of higher class, a more British aristocrat. Plus, well, we've been watching too much Downton Abbey, and I feel like you have
If you have to go for a cup of tea, mate, I'd recommend you start off on a builder's cup of tea, as we call it.
What is that?
So that's a big mug, first of all, and you get some English breakfast tea and you brew it nice and strong, and you leave the tea bag in the cup to make it even stronger, and you put some milk in it and about 6 sugars, and now you're talking a builder's cup of tea.
See, I don't know if I like that, because I don't like anything in my coffee. I don't like sweetener. I don't really like sugar a lot. So I like bitterness a little bit and spicy. That's what my tastes are like. So yep. Is there a tea that's like that?
You might want to try the Earl Grey. Then.
That's what I usually drink, yeah.
Yeah, that might get your taste buds zinging a little bit, the old Earl Grey. But again, a little pretentious for my liking, if I don't like to say.
That is a bit ironic coming from you. Mr. Music Critic.
That's it.
It's funny though, like everything you've said at this point, I've completely understood and got with. But the music thing is the one that I got emotional, personal with. How dare you talk about my Chris, music?
The Bugs Bunny. It's great. It took me ages to think of that.
Well, the Bugs Bunny, that just works with the company because UpDoc Media. You know what's UpDoc?
But well, the music doesn't work. Let's put it like that with your company. You need to get into people's earbuds. You need to make it more epic. That's all I'm saying.
I'm gonna just take like the Titanic theme and put it in there.
I'm thinking a big ballad or something. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe like the Braveheart music or something.
Or Bat Hell Meatloaf.
Or just do like Benny Hill or something because you're on.
Or the Imperial March out of Star Wars.
Oh, that's yeah. Yeah, that'd be good before I get sued. But yeah, that'd be fantastic. I should do that. That Star Wars movie, you still get a bunch of hits on you opening it up, the Sith Lord.
Yeah, I thought I'd do the evil rather than the good side.
Yeah, you did a good job. Back to the dry needling. If anybody's still paying attention to that conversation, what if let's talk hypothetical. And I did when I was practicing, I did a dry needling course with Maya Payne Seminars. And I think it's just like anything else. When I did it, I really enjoyed learning it. I enjoyed what he was presenting, the science. And when you're going through it, it's this excitement of getting something that has the potential to help people. I think if that doesn't excite you as a clinician when you're taking con ed classes, one, it's a really incredible, terribly, terrible con ed class. And two, you're just a terrible clinician. So that's the point of con ed, is you learn more things to better people. And when I learned dry needling, that was exciting. I hated doing the class because you get needled like crazy, and it hurts and it doesn't feel good because a lot of times we don't have issues. You just have to practice, which sucked. But then I started practicing. I was doing a lot of dry needling like anything else when you first learn it, right? I'm sure when you teach your course, people start doing that stuff right away because they really want to help their patients. So I was needling and it was a similar thought process, like you were describing, Adam. Some people really benefit from it. Some people really didn't. So I started to do what I think every scientific mind would do, is I started to, in my head, classify which type of patients and issues I was benefiting from needling. And it wasn't the thought process of my skill is wrong. I was thinking, okay, maybe it's certain things are better for needling. So then I would focus my needling on certain things. And then I'd keep reading and practicing, and I would do less and less and less of it. I would still do it for very certain things. So what started out as like a 70% of patients turned into like 5 to 10% of patients, turned into just pretty much runners getting it, or, you know, very small populations. So let's say science and research keeps evolving and protocols are developed that prove to be very effective, sensitive, and specific. Would you switch your mind to that, to needling and doing it again? Or would you still stick to what you're doing now, even if there's a similar efficacy?
I am always open to new ideas and new treatment, but there'd have to be a significant switch in the evidence base to show that dry needling had a specific effect that was above and beyond anything other than any other treatments that I can do. Because the other thing is, let's not forget that, you know, an invasive procedure like sticking a needle in someone isn't without risk. So, you know, you've got to weigh up the pros and the cons. And I know the risks are small, and I know, you know, they're minimal and being careful, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, you're still sticking a needle in and around structures that could potentially cause harm. So, you know, I always weigh that up. So, you know, there has to be a significant benefit to do any procedure where there is a potential to do harm. So, yes is the answer if the evidence shows that it starts to show specific effects for X patient in X conditions over and above and beyond placebo effects that, again, minimal chances of risk and numbers needed to treat, etc., are acceptable, then yeah, I would start doing it again, is the simple answer, because that's the process of being an evidence-based clinician. You follow what the evidence tells you.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. And I think another critical point that you brought up with needling is the patient awareness, because a lot more patients are learning about it. There's more, a little bit more mass appeal. So I would have people calling and coming in just for dry needling.
And that presented a problem in itself. Like towards the end, I had a little spiel about needling. When, you know, you treat a runner or something of highly competitive people, they want to get better quicker. So they tell their friends, and that, you know, they remember the needling because it was the most dramatic thing they did in the treatment. Like they forgot the 40 minutes of exercise. They just remember the 10 minutes of needling because it was new and it was intense. Yep. So when they tell their friends, they're like, oh, you got to go see this guy. And, you know, the dry needling really helped. It was re-educating and and just like deconstructing when people came in and their perceptions again. It was, listen, I can't really tell you what I did with that person. I'm glad you're here. But if you're here just for needling, you're going to be thoroughly disappointed because this is what's going to happen. And they need to be aware of everything. If you're not telling the patients all the risks and what could or could not happen, you're very much doing them a disservice or even negligent to that point. Like when towards the end, the treatment, when patients would ask me, well, what is this doing? The best I could tell them was the best that I knew at the time. But this is what the research is showing. We really don't know why it works. We know sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. It's going to hurt. This is what it's going to feel like. Do you still want to do this? Right? I tried to do my best to eliminate as much of placebo as possible, almost to the point of trying to scare them, trying to make it a placebo moment, and to see if it actually works. And still, it was almost pretty much the same stuff. So I felt better as a clinician. I felt like I was more objective and honest with them, and then I was able to combine it into a full treatment. But I completely agree with you. I think whatever the latest research and your comfort as a clinician produces, that's what you need to follow, regardless of what stance you're in right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, that belief of using informed consent is fundamental. It's, you know, it's our first and foremost rule that we should obey. You know, the patient has to be fully informed, and again, that's another issue where our biases can kick in, because we can inform the patient based on our biases, which again can skew results and outcomes, because you can preempt things. You can set patients up to succeed or to fail because of the way you explain expectations and what's going to happen with the treatment. So yeah, it's a good point.
Absolutely. All right. I think we've talked for God knows how long and covered everything from tea to needling to exercises to shoulders to your absolute
dodgy podcast music.
Yeah, to your obvious no taste in music.
So what's the other thing you don't like to do? You don't like to date podcasts, do you? So this is the 16th of March. It is exactly 7 p.m. In the year 2016.
I thought you say the year of our Lord. You Brits.
Our Sith Lord.
Oh, well done. Well done. What did you think of the Star Wars movie? Let's finish out on that.
Yeah, I thought, again, everybody, it's hard, isn't it? Because when you've got that massive expectation, like you do with lots of things in manual therapy, etc., but when you've got that massive expectation, you know, you're just praying and hoping it's going to live up to those expectations. And it took me a couple of weeks to see it, because my wife, God bless her, she decided to do a little special birthday treat for me and take me to this specialist boutique cinema to watch it in this little nice environment with a meal and everything. But I mean, I had to wait 2 weeks after launch before I could actually go and see it. So I was trying to avoid all people talking about it. And I got the hint from some people that are like, oh, this is disappointing. And my heart was sinking and sinking and sinking, and I was like getting close to the day I was going to watch it, and I was like, please don't let this be bad as everybody's been making out. My expectations are so high. And I watched it and I fucking loved it. Don't care what they say. I think it's a new evolution of the Star Wars franchise, and I think he knocked it out of the park. I think it had some flaws, of course. It's not perfect, but what the fuck is? But I loved it. I thought, you know, it's a great way to start off the new evolution for the next generation of Star Wars fans. Absolutely.
Yeah, people bitch and moan about Star Wars regardless, I feel like. And
yeah,
I know the biggest complaint I heard that it was just pretty much the same thing as A New Hope. It was A New Hope 2.0. And I was like, if you're creating the story of Star Wars again after the prequels are made, what else can you do except make a similar New Hope movie? Because that people love that emotion, that feeling, that storytelling narrative. And if it was anything different, then people would be complaining that it's not, it doesn't fit into the Star Wars theme, and it's not like the originals, and it sucks again. Yeah. Like, I agree with you. I thought it was a great story, obviously with some flaws, but I think I was messaging you like once a day, little hints of stuff, and there's so many times I would just write something and delete it.
I was like blocking people left, right. I don't go off social media much, as you know, but there was almost a 2-week ban on social media because I was like, I just don't want to see anything.
I was thinking about just sending you one letter of Han is dead.
No!
H-A, one letter a day until right before the day that you see the movie, and you'd spell them all together.
Yeah, then I would have definitely have blocked you, and we would not be recording this podcast. Yeah.
Well, if in retrospect, if I knew you'd be talking about my music like you were, I probably would have done it. but yeah, I'm excited for the next one coming out. Should be really cool. I'm excited to see more Luke Skywalker, and just it was a really good.
And see if Ren is Obi-Wan's daughter, right?
I really think she is.
Yeah, it's got to be, really. I think seeing you piece it together, absolutely.
Yeah,
not Luke's, Obi, and say Obi-Wan's.
Yeah, I'm 100% on that theory that she's
old Alex Guinness was a dog.
For listeners that don't know who you are, for some act of God or chance, who are you? Where can they find you on social media? Tell them a little bit about your courses. Are you coming to the U.S. at all? Where can I find you? And punch you in your throat for talking about my music.
I live most of my life via social media, so Twitter is my main area where I'm at, so I'm on Twitter most of the time. So I'm at Adam Meekins, or one word, or under the pseudonym of The Sports Physio. I am on Facebook a little bit, but I'm not on there as much. Again, just Adam Meekins, but I find Facebook as a social media forum a little bit more challenging than I do Twitter, because people can just go on and on and on and on and on and on. I, God forbid, hope Twitter don't do this 10,000 word bloody limit thing that they're planning on doing.
It'll happen.
The best thing about Twitter is, as I say, it just shuts people up into very small, bite-sized bits. So that's where I spend most of my time. I've got my website, the Sports Physio. So that's www.thesports.physio, where I do my blogs and do my controversial comments, views, and opinions, and get the odd guest blogger on there as well. And courses, I teach my shoulder course, Simplifying the Shoulder, or as I've called it, Complex Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. Various different places, and say all the dates are on my website. And I am coming to the US, not this year, but next year, 2017. So with the lovely Sarah Haig and Sandy Hilton over at Entropy in Chicago. So I'll be over there in March in 2017 to simplify the shoulder. And it's going to be a joint course with old Eric as well, Eric Mira.
Nice.
So that should be good.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, Sandy and Sarah. Awesome place there if you haven't been. Really good place for courses, and really just awesome setup that they have there. I was there for Jerry's course, and it's really cool. Really cool host, really awesome city. So it's a win-win all around, and fantastic. Yeah, so go see Adam before he becomes a dinosaur, and then he can't teach you anything. If you had to leave our listeners with one thought of where physical therapy is heading and where you would like to see it head, what would you say?
I'd say let's develop a movement for movement.
What does that mean? That just made my head hurt.
I mean, let's focus on movement and let's get that as our priority. Let's get people moving more. Let's look at making sure every interaction we have with a patient is about maximizing movement. So it's not just about pain. It's not just about tendons. It's about getting people moving more. Motion is lotion, baby. Rest is rust.
And on that note, Adam, thanks for joining us. And I hope you enjoy your dry needling and tape. And if you ever happen to needle yourself too hard and you're bleeding, just put the tape over top of it and fix it up with the manual therapy, and you're good to go.
Problem solved.
All right, man. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me, Gene. Really appreciate it.
All right. Hope you enjoyed listening to that episode as much as we enjoyed recording it. Look, it was a lot of fun talking with Adam. We've communicated before on Twitter, and it was great to finally get him on air. We've been going back and forth trying to schedule
And we see eye to eye on a lot of topics, as you probably have heard. And we don't agree on some other ones, as you probably have heard, like our music selection, which he has no idea about. But joking aside, he does raise a lot of valid points. And we've talked about this on previous podcasts. Having discussions, even arguments, as long as you can remain focused on the principle and not get personal, it only helps everyone out. The moment that it gets personal and petty, then it just becomes entertainment for everyone else to watch, but it does no good. So let us know what you thought of the episode. Tweet at us at Therapy Insiders. Check out Adam at Adam Meekins on Twitter as well. Congratulations to Urson again on his baby boy being born. Very cool stuff. We're really happy and excited for him and Nicole. As always, thank you for listening. Thank you for the reviews on iTunes. We really, really appreciate those. And please keep those coming. Check us out on iTunes. Just type in Therapy Insiders or check out the medical podcast when we're usually around the top 20. We couldn't have done it without you. We are doing our digital marketing and content creation services with UpDoc Media. So check out UpDocMedia.com. If you need any of those services, be happy to chat with you. Catch you again on next week's episode of Therapy Insiders. Thanks for listening.